Gentlemen, did you find it interesting last night, realizing that Yosha told us that there would be signs in the sky upon his return, and that he spoke of the darkness of that night, and that the light of the moon will turn blood red, and it will be an eclipse, therefore, that night, that the next supermoon, blood moon, full eclipse, is in Tabernacles of 2033. Year 6,000, yeah. You know, all
that's really fascinating.
All these, you know, idiots were writing books and talking about the end of the world was supposed to take place last night because this was the, you know, the four right. blood moons, and they were supposed to be the hand of God as opposed to the shadow of the earth. Maybe their God is the earth. That would be in keeping with the pagan religions of yesteryear. But on Yahweh's calendar, the dates that he celebrates is a year 2,000, 4,000, and 6,000 Yom. That's when his Moed Mikre are established, his covenant is established, and the Moed Mikre promises are fulfilled. And 2033 is year 6,000 Yom. That's the year he's going to return on Yom Kippurim and camp out with humankind beginning on Sukkah. What's interesting is on Yom Kippurim, you wouldn't be able to see the sky, because it'll be so obscured with the leftovers of all of the, you know, the asteroid strike, the nuclear war, all of that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But by Sukkah, he will have cleaned up the debris. You'll see it.
Yeah, what's fascinating about this, first of all, I would say it would be really nice if there was some sort of, like, timeline. I'm not going to end up sitting down and taking the time to make this, but sort of timeline comparative, compare and contrast calendar for the calendar that you're talking about is, you know, the year, you know, 4,000 Yah, 6,000 Yah, that mm-hmm. calendar timeline as compared to the presently recognized Jewish calendar timeline compared to the, mm-hmm. you know, present Gregorian calendar and all that sort of thing, so that, you know, people could see, you know, can easily see why so much confusion reigns over all these different dates, you know.
Yeah, I think the primary reason for confusion, first, the reason that there's a difference between the Hebkal calendar, the rabbinic calendar, and Yahweh's calendar, is several fold. One is they did not recognize the arrival of the Messiah, of Yosha. Mm-hmm. And so they missed year 4,000 Yah. The Torah says that the greater light will become visible as a sign in the fourth day. They missed the fourth day. Mm-hmm. And so by missing the fourth day, their calendar's not synced. Second, they missed all of the signs that Yah was talking about. 967 BCE, 968 BCE was the establishment of the temple of Mount Moriah. That's a Yobel year. That's, you know, year 3,000 Yah. And the reason they're not precise on the timing of the time from Adam and Chawa being booted from the garden to the time that we are now is that there are three specific genealogies, dates, duration periods between the birth and the next generation. In the rabbinic Masoretic text that are exactly the difference between how far they're off in their numbering and Yahweh's actual calendar that are properly reflected in the Septuagint. Mm-hmm. So that's how they're off. The reason that Christians are off is that they're clueless. I mean, excuse
it's a solar calendar for starters.
Yeah, the Christian calendar is a solar calendar. It's a Roman calendar. It was put in place by the Roman Catholic Church based upon them growing out of Rome, which is why we have 2 months that were inserted named Julian and Augusto. July and August in the middle of the year to celebrate the divinity of the first two emperors, the first two popes of Imperial Rome, from which the Roman Catholic Church is derived. So their calendar celebrating Christmas and Easter and the like from that point on is wholly divorced from Yahweh. So it is impossible for a Christian author to get it right. Like the guys like Hagee, they were writing Four Blood Moons. You know, he called it a sign to Israel. Well, if it was a sign to Israel, then you've got no Christianity because all the promises were made to Israel, and if Israel is getting a sign even today, then God didn't replace them with the Gentile church.
Well, and more recently, Jonathan Cahn, who's Jewish and is a, you know, Messianic Jew or, you know, Christian, Jewish Christian or whatever, you know, I followed his writings and presentations, and then I've also been following one of the more crazy and speculative doomsayer sites on the internet and that sort of thing, and this all bollocks stuff because he starts talking about things like, you know, societal desecrations bringing on the judgment of God. And as you're, you know, so prone to say, God is not involved with, you know, the Goyim nations. God is not going to punish America for desecration because it's not sacred in the first place.
No. He warns Americans. I mean, he warns Americans that, you know, you've done a lot of things that are stupid, or wrong, or immoral, or evil. But
Cahn cites abortion and the marriage thing as desecrations that are going to bring out with judgment.
But the fact of the matter is that God's not going to destroy America. America destroys America.
He's going to destroy America.
Right. America destroys America. It's not God's doing. We're well on the way of accomplishing that. But the reality here is that that the reason that Christians get it wrong is because they can't think. They would say that these are signs, Hagee, you know, writing his letter, these are signs to Israel, and yet these eclipses were not visible in Israel. And the four blood moons that took place near the what they would call the High Holy Days on the Jewish calendar, which are stupid again, they're Yahweh's invitations to meet, and they're not holy days, they're set apart days. There's two issues with that. One is that their proof statement of these are the things that happened the last time were insignificant as it relates to Israel. Meaningless. What's important to God, if he's going to design a sign like this, is if there was one in 33 CE, that would be meaningful. If there was one in, again, there is one now in 2033, that's meaningful. But apart from that, nothing like this is meaningful. But also, if Yahweh this is what the thing that was so stupid about Hagee. If he is going to time a sign around not the Christian holidays of Christmas and Easter, but instead around his seven Moed Mikre, Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and in the fall around Yom Kippurim and Sukkah, isn't he still using his original calendar? I mean, at that point, wouldn't you just give up and say, oops, we're wrong?
Right. But now it's, you know, you get on this, you know, people like Hagee and Cahn seem to get caught up in things like manifest destiny and, exceptionalism and all that sort of silliness. And,
I know, they do.
You know, almost like America is God's new Israel, that type of thing, you know.
They do.
And it's just really crazy. And what's really sad is, I mean, like, there's thousands of people, you know, absorbed in all this stuff.
There are.
And like, on the site I was talking about, like, there you have the normalcy people mocking the doomy people and people actually talking about, you know, having horrible feelings of foreboding and panic attacks and anxiety. And I was like, this is just nuts.
Oh, yeah. They were predicting the end of the world as we know it based upon last night. You know, what I would say to such an incompoops is this. Why would Yahweh use something that is so predictable, so natural, to be a sign of what is coming, when he provided thousands of words, tens of thousands of words in testimony, presenting the entirety of human history, past, present, and future, through his prophets, so that we would know precisely what is going to happen and when it's going to happen.
Right. And they're very resistant to such argumentation or anything that requires actually slowing down, actually doing some thought or study. You know, we're talking about very, you know, shallow thinking, knee-jerk responding, people who can't seem to slow down and think this stuff through. And they have very little tolerance for rational.
Yeah, well, gave us his whole time schedule. It's a 6+1 schedule. I know, 6,000 years from the time that Adam and Chawa were booted out of Eden, we are being brought back. Those of us who have accepted the covenant's terms and conditions are being brought back into Eden. The entire earth is going to be camping out with God, beginning on Sukkah. And he is going to return on the essential day of reconciliations on Yom Kippurim. The 5 days in between are so designated to cleanse the earth, to remove all traces of religion and politics and militarism, all of the pollution of humankind, to return the earth back to an ideal Eden-like condition. No religion, no politics, no militarism, no media. Perfect.
Right. And what's, you know, what's also a shame is that there are so many mockers. You know, I think of Psalm 1 that, you know, talks about blessed is he who doesn't, you know, hang with the scornfulness, scoffers.
Right.
And there's so many psychologically cruel scoffers who, you know, derive pleasure from mocking to scorn these poorly, you know, these sad, you know, people. It's just really a shame. There's no empathy in them at all. And, you know, it's,
it's just... I'm going to tell you, though, it's hard to display empathy when you really have to be a fool, to be played for a fool by these foolish men. I mean, it is difficult. It is so obvious that they're wrong. It's so obvious that Christianity is wrong. It's so obvious that Roman Catholicism is wrong. It's so obvious that Islam is wrong. I went out to dinner last night with my son and daughter-in-law. And we unfortunately sat next to a Muslim family. Two little babies, the dad working on his cell phone all night. And the wife sitting there in her hijab. And I felt zero empathy for them. None. I mean, Islam is the dumbest religion ever conceived. If you believe that a rapist and pedophile, that a man who was a terrorist and mass murderer, who was an avowed liar, was God's spokesperson to change everything that he had previously revealed, and you've got to be a nut. So how do you develop empathy for those so willing to be deceived? Yahweh spoke. This is the name that very few people know. No question that it's Yahweh. Yod, Hey, Wah, Hey, four vowels, all easily pronounced based upon the thousands of words they appear on in the Hebrew language. And Yahweh spoke to Moshe for the purpose of saying, converse with the children of Yisrael. Now, so as he begins to share this with us, he's got the word for word, debar. Then he has the word for to say, amar. And then he has the word for word, debar, again. You know what? These people that are focused on signs in the sky, why aren't they instead focused on the words? This is God speaking. Why not listen to his words? Why not observe his words as opposed to looking up at the sky?
Well, obviously they don't trust his words, do they?
No. No. I think if you wanted to know who he is, what he wants, what's expected of us, what he's offering, that you would observe what he had to say. Listen to what he had to say. And Yahweh spoke to Moshe. Moshe means to draw out. Moshe's role was to draw the chosen people, the Israelites, out of Egypt, which was the most religious and political, militaristic place on earth. It's the place with the most degraded economic system, one based entirely on slavery. And it was the place where man and God were one. Not man and real gods, but pretentious men and wannabe gods. we're one and the same. The name Moshe means to draw out. He's drawing us away from those things, which is exactly what Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, Shavuah, Teruah, and Kippurim do, taking us to the promised land, which is Sukkah. And Yahweh spoke these words to Moshe for the purpose of saying, converse, speak with the children of Yisrael. Now, for the Christians would say, well, speaking to the children of Yisrael, we're the church. Oh, yeah, you are the church. Does Yahweh ever say, speak to the church?
No. He doesn't have a word, well, pagan word for church.
Okay. He doesn't even have a word for church.
Well, probably not, yeah.
He doesn't even have a word for church. All he could say about church, which is named after a sun goddess, is that it would be the way of the Gentiles. Don't emulate it. Don't copy it. Don't follow it. Don't engage.
Process, yeah.
Yeah, don't do that. And so here's Yahweh saying to the children of Yisrael, children, Bene, these are the sons, but children of Yisrael. Children, why do you think he's spoke? Why didn't he just say, speak to Yisrael? Why do you say, Bene, the children of Yisrael? Do you have any idea why he would designate them as children? Was he trying to besmirch them and saying they were childish?
No, they're family. They're his
kids. Yeah, they're his children. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's his family.
And the descendants of Jacob. Jacob.
Yeah, yeah, of course. And they are, from his perspective, which is Heavenly Father, Israel is family.
Yeah.
And Israel is a word that is based upon Sarah, who was the mother of the first mother in the covenant, Sarah. It means to engage with, to endure with, to be empowered by. And that's the heart of it. It's preceded with Ish. Ish is the Hebrew word for individual. So individual who endures with, is empowered by, who engages with. El is the Hebrew word for God. So, and Yahweh spoke, yeah, to Moshe, the one who draws out, for the purpose of saying, speak to and with the children of Yisrael, of those who engage and endure with God. So, on the 15th day of the 7th month is the Chag, festival feast. So we talked about what a feast is all about. How about a festival? What is the festival implications of this?
A party, dancing, singing.
Singing for joy. So singing and dancing are the behaviors along with feasting, eating and drinking. So eating, drinking, dancing, and singing. Those are the, aren't those the four things that are the verbal aspects of Chag?
I would think. Everywhere I look, it says so.
Yeah, that's all I've ever read about Chag. It's a feast, so eating and drinking, it's a festival, so specifically singing and dancing. It's a party.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that what we do when we throw parties?
That's what we do.
So on the 15th day of the 7th month is a Chag, a festival feast, a coming together and celebration, a party. Tells you a lot about God. Not only does the name of this day, of shelters, which is the next word, of Sukkah, tabernacles and tents representing a protective covering, a sheltered dwelling place where families live, the tabernacle for the Ark of the Covenant, for 7 days, in proximity to and in association with, to approach Yahweh. So what did you find when you looked up Sukkah?
Interesting. You have a tent, a canopy, huts,
okay,
temporary shelters.
Okay. Let's go one at a time. A tent.
Okay.
A tent is a is almost in all occasions an unassuming, unpretentious building. It's not even a humble person is going to live in a tent. A pretentious person is going to live in a palace. Where does Yahweh live when he's camping out with us?
He lives in a tent.
What does he want us to live in when we camp out with him?
Live in a tent.
That would be unpretentious, wouldn't it?
That would be pretty unpretentious.
Yeah.
Where was Yahusha born?
In a tent.
In a tent.
Yeah, in a tent.
In a temporary shelter.
In a temporary shelter.
Yeah.
You know, as a matter of fact, they say he was born in a, what did they say, a manger. Yeah, but we think of manger as a, you know, you see all the Christmas nativity things with the wood structure and the, they didn't build mangers out of wood. They didn't have enough wood. I mean, it's in places where people had lived for a long time, the forests were gone. Whatever wood exists that would make a permanent structure, I mean, almost all of it was turned into ships. And if you had some wood to make a shelter, it would be your home, not your animal's home. And so they were in a tent.
Mm-hmm.
So it says that those who are camping out with God, including God himself, are unpretentious. It also says this is temporary. Was Eden eternal?
I'm sorry?
Eden, the Garden of Eden, the shelter. It's a shelter. Gan Eden is the enclosed shelter of great joy. Gan, for example, is synonymous with the concept of shelters. It is, Gan means an enclosed and sheltered place. So, Eden, was it, did Yahweh ever tell us that Eden's eternal?
No.
No. Temporary, right? Temporary residence for Adam and Chawa.
Right.
The millennial Shabbat is how long? The celebration of Shabbat here on Earth, the celebration of Sukkah.
Oh, 1,000 years.
Is 1,000 years forever?
Mm-hmm. No, hardly.
No, a long period of time, but is it forever? How is 1,000 years compared to eternity?
Grain of sand.
Okay. So it's temporary, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so it's a temporary shelter. That's again a good sign, because we aren't going to be camping out even on the entirety of the earth forever. It's 1,000 years. And then Yahweh creates a new universe. It's going to be important that our tent, our shelter, is movable, that we can take it wherever we're going to go. And it's also nice that when you ever gone backpacking, Kirk?
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
I don't know if Glenn, if you're still with us. You ever been backpacking? Well, I don't know if we, I think we've
been
just...
Yeah.
Been backpacking. Okay. When you went backpacking, where was your tent when you were moving?
On your back.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're carrying it with you, right?
You have a caddy.
Yeah. So when you go off and explore the universe with Yahweh, so that, you know, you're going to pitch your tent in the places you think are interesting, you're bringing your tent with you, aren't you? You're bringing your covering with you. That's like the set apart spirit when we are immersed in the garment of light. Goes with us wherever we go.
Right.
This tent goes with us wherever we go. That's the beauty of it being portable. And it is exciting to think that the reason we're not going to have these you know, grand mansions is that we're going to be going everywhere. We're going to be on the move almost constantly.
Yeah.
Celebrating and exploring the universe. It's going to be really fun. So this day is called Shelters. So what else do you learn about shelters other than it was a temporary and protective covering?
Well, I like the little word on canopy, because that implies, because a lot of what they did, because there wasn't a lot of wood there, you know, there was stonemasons more than, because they would use the wood for fire anyhow. They did use the palms.
Yeah, by the way, when we look at the ruins in the ancient world, just from that point of view, when you look at the buildings that were erected in Israel as they dig down now and find evidence of things. Lots of wood structures and lots of wood beams, or do you find lots of chiseled stone?
Chiseled stone.
Yeah, chiseled stone. And do you think that they chiseled stone to make protections for animals that were equipped to live outside, or you're going to go through the work of chiseling and stacking stone? That's going to be for your covering.
Yeah,
your family.
King and all the rest of the family, yeah.
Yeah, I betcha. So, yeah, this idea that they were in a manger design like the Christian nativity scenes is utter nonsense. All right, so we've got a shelter. It's a sukkah. And the sukkah is one of those words that Yahweh introduces to us elsewhere. For example, the derivation of sukkah is sukkoth. The difference there is you've got the O in the middle of it. and it's first used in the Baba Sheikh. It's interesting that Sukkah is from Sukkot, and that Sukkot is as the wall. What is the wall?
The wall is when you addition to the family, you enlarge the tent.
Right, enlarge and secure the tent. It's the wall.
That's
tent peg.
There,
Jacob. Jacob's rather important. Glenn, you mentioned Jacob. He is the individual that was renamed Yisrael, the third in line in the covenant. He traveled to Sukkoth, the tabernacle of protection, and he built a house and made shelters for his animals. He built a house and made shelters for his animals. So Sukkah, we find, is a place that means tabernacle of perfection, of protection. Mm-hmm. And that the first time the word is introduced, this is in Bereshit 33:17. So this is in the first book of the Torah. The first place that it's introduced, it was about building a home, a house. That's what tabernacles represent. It's our house. It's our home. It's our ability to, our family, the covenant family, to camp out with God. And a shelter for his animals.
Yeah.
Now, I think the shelter for the animals is twofold. One is, I think it is predictive of the fact that this booth that Mary and Yosef would be tabernacling in, would be camping out, would be enjoying shelters in, may well have been a tent,
yeah.
A tent that that a wealthier family may have had for their animals. And it's possible that Miriam and Yosef didn't have the funds to take a tent with them and relied on the generosity of someone who says, oh, yeah, I've got a tent out there for my animals. You can go stay in that. And so this was a home for the covenant and a shelter for animals. It's also interesting that what was the one thing that Yahweh is shown doing with Adam and in Eden? There's only really one thing other than talking to them.
Walking.
Well, he walked in the cool of the morning, so we know he walked with them. But what was the one thing where Yahweh just takes a moment out and tells us of something that they did? There's only one example of something that that Yahweh and Adam did together that we're told about.
Name the animals.
Right. He marched all of the animals before him. So from Yahweh's perspective, the most interesting aspect of enjoying camping out together and enjoying life together is life. That from God's perspective, life has to be the most enjoyable part of creation. That's what he wanted to show Adam. And so the fact that shelters is not just for the family home, but also for animals, tells me that in the celebration of Sukkah, we're going to have animals that make the celebration of Sukkah. But that in eternity as we celebrate Sukkah,
mm-hmm.
there are going to be animals there. Life. I think that's the most interesting part. Don't you? I mean, if I could go back in time, wouldn't you want to go back and see the dinosaurs?
Oh, gosh. All that stuff, yeah.
Yeah. But I'm not crazy about seeing the first,
protozoans,
yeah. But I really am interested. I want to see. Yeah, I mean, I want to see. You know, I want to see a brontosaurus. I'd like to see a triceratops. You know, so long as I'm wearing my garment of light, I'm want to see a tyrannosaurus.
I'd like to go to the Natural Museum of history and stuff.
Yeah.
The bones and stuff. Sure, that's cool stuff.
Yeah, be cool. So anyway, Sukkah tells us what it was all about. It was about building a home for one's family and a shelter for one's animals. So now the children and the Exodus begins. This is the, you know, this is Yahweh's means of taking us to the whole purpose of the Exodus was to go to, move to the promised land. So now the children of Israel traveled from Ramesses. Ramesses is the city named after the Egyptian sun god. Yeah.
Amun-Ra.
Amun-Ra.
And Amun-Ra.
Yeah, Amun-Ra. Yeah, woke up, folks. But Amun-Ra was the sun god. This was a city named for the sun god. Now, a lot of people get all up in their in a twit over the fact that that is, they say that that's the Torah being wrong, and that the Exodus could not have taken place under the Egyptian pharaoh Ramesses. And I say it doesn't say that Ramesses was pharaoh. It says that the city was Ramesses, and the Ra existed long before the pharaoh chose that name. Long before. And so there is no correlation, and long after as well, too. So the Torah doesn't say that Ramesses the Great or was the pharaoh of Egypt. It just says that the city was being built was Ramesses. Now, if you were really rational and open-minded, rather than going where the words do not lead, which is to condemn this based upon it was, they're saying it was Pharaoh Ramesses, and you know, even the movie Exodus, I think, made that mistake.
Oh, yeah.
What they should have done is said, wow, because this is written Ramesses. It's written Ramesses in 1400 CE. We were able to pronounce it using the five vowels of the 22 letters in the Hebrew language for 3,000 years before anyone could read Egyptian hieroglyphics. It wasn't until the Rosetta Stone in the 19th century that we could begin to read Egyptian hieroglyphics and begin to translate them. And yet here is an accurate transliteration of the name of the Egyptian god, and therefore the name of the city named after the Egyptian god. And so 3,000 years before man could pronounce it, here you go.
So at what point does someone think, well, maybe the words are more important than all this other stuff? I mean, I like archaeology,
right. Yeah,
history, but, I mean, that's just verifying things and putting the pieces together. But at what point do you not come to the conclusion that the words in the Torah are
right.
100% accurate if you translate them correctly?
Yeah, and by the way, here is Yahweh demonstrating the first rule of translation. Mm-hmm. It's a rule that religious copy editors would not follow.
No.
And that is that you transliterate names. Ramesses is Ramesses in Egyptian and in Hebrew, just as it is Ramesses in English and in Greek.
Well, they were,
and so he transliterated the name,
right.
Didn't he?
And the Christians will do it, and only if it's a pagan name, like Nebuchadnezzar, king of the...
Oh, yeah. They'll do Nebuchadnezzar.
They don't seem to have trouble with those things.
Right, yeah. And they'll do it for Satan.
Mm-hmm.
But they won't do it for Yahweh. They won't do it for Yahusha. But they won't even do it for Yahuda.
No.
Or Yahud.
They had those days.
Yes. So here we are saying, now the children of Yisrael traveled from Ramesses to Sukkoth. About 600,000 aside from children. Why do you think there was a reference to 600,000?
Well, six being man.
Right. Six being the number of man. That's why there were 600,000. 600,000, the number of man. Then they set out from Sukkoth and camped in Etham at the edge of the wilderness. So Sukkah is a journey away from religious schemes, from political schemes, and human oppression to the place where we can camp out with God. He defined his term in his first use. You know, that's one of the things that I learned about translation. First, you know, the first rule is transliterate names and translate words. And transliterate means you replicate the sound using the letters of another language, the words, the names, and you translate, which means you render the meaning of the word as completely and accurately as possible in the from one language to another. The second is that Yahweh is really smart, and he doesn't leave anything to chance. So if you run across a word that you think has the distinct possibility of enduring religious shading. The first thing to do, the right thing to do, is to go to its first use and then consider, how does Yahweh use the word? And when you do that and you go to the first two uses, you pretty well zeroed in on it. So Sukkah is a place that is a protected place of shelter for Jacob, the covenant's children, that is that serves as a home for family and for animals. Well, that's a pretty good definition. And the second, and it's temporary as a home and a shelter. And the second is, it's the place that Yahweh leads us to after we have been drawn away from religious and political oppression. It's the place we first get to camp out with God. Marvelous. I mean, he's defined the terms. Are you going to argue with his definition?
No, he's the boss.
Yeah, he's the boss. That's what Sukkah means, and therefore you ought to convey that.
So his party.
Yeah, it is his party.
He's going to party, you know. He can make me do whatever.
Right, right. And they, when it even says here, and they set out from Sukkah and camped out. So if you're camping out, that's the purpose of Sukkah. It's to camp out with God. Now we find another reference to Sukkah in Yonah. Yonah is Yahweh's dove is God, or Yahweh is the dove, if you were to translate it literally. Yonah, corrupted to Jonah. I don't know what Jonah means. I know what Yonah means. That should not be surprising. Consider that this book in its entirety is a depiction of the set-apart spirit and the most set-apart one, Yahusha. And it's dedicated to the protective nature of Yahweh's set-apart spirit. As a matter of fact, the whale, it's really a metaphor for being enveloped in and just completely enveloped in Yahweh's set-apart spirit. That's the reason why the dove is synonymous with Yahweh's spirit, and the man's name means is the basis of the Hebrew word for dove, which is the symbol, one of the more tangible symbols of the Spirit. So, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you know, the first letter of the word is Shemach, and Shemach is written as a thorny bush or a thorn where you have a protective, that they were used to protect the sheep. They would gather these temporary things out in the field at night and wrap the things around so the herd would be protected, or the herd or the, the sheep would be protected from the flock, rather, would be protected from the wolves and all
right.
the other creatures. So, I mean,
right. And Yahweh's into protecting his children from the wolf, which would be from Shaul, the Benjamite wolf, who was the wolf dressed in sheep's clothing.
Yes.
And Yonah, Yah's dove, went out and made a shelter, a sukkah, and he relaxed in the shade. So protection is found in the shade of the Almighty, the shade of the Almighty Spirit. In Job 27:18, we find Sukkah is a home which a watchman made. Someone who is observant makes a home called a Sukkah. So the observant individual camps out with God that way. A Sukkah is a protected dwelling place, a home in which people live, in Job 27:18. Prophetic presentation begins. The daughter of Sion, which is the signpost along the way, is left like a sukkah shelter in a vineyard, like a watchman's, an observant person's sukkah tent in the cultivated field, like a protective city. Boy, there's really no doubt here, is there? This is pretty clear stuff. So he's equating this sukkah shelter in a vineyard to a sign. Well, the vineyard represents the Pesach Passover. The blood of the Passover lamb is shared. It's where we drink wine in addition to consuming lamb for the benefit of immortality. And so sukkah, a shelter in the vineyard, is a Sion, sign along the way.
All the way to the end when it's holding up the tent.
Right. Exactly. And it's an observant person's tent in a cultivated field. Cultivated field means there's good things
fruit.
Growing.
Fruit.
Yeah, good thing. Yeah, good fruit. Good things growing there. In a cultivated field, the weeds, which is religion and politics, militarism, the weeds have been removed. And not only is there good food, that which is nurturing for you and healthy and good growing there, it's being tended to. Cultivated field. We're tending to it. So it's a tent there. It's a home there. It's like a protected city. It's a, and by the way, the Hebrew word for city is the same as the Hebrew word for eternity. So it's an eternal place, a protected place for all eternity. A shelter to provide shade and refuge and protection from storms. You know, the shade is used because it's protection from the sun. The sun is the primary guise of Satan. And storms is used to describe Satan because of their destructive and deadly effect, and also because storms come with a wind, and Satan is a ruach spirit. Therefore, he's equated with wind.
It makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, and there's also circular reasoning that's associated with Satan's wiles. So it protects you from the sun god mythology of, for example, of Roman Catholicism. And it's a refuge from Satan's circular reasoning and damaging influence from the storms. Amos 9:10. Sukkah represents the house and tabernacle of Dode, which has fallen and will be raised up and rebuilt. Well, there's only one covenant. That covenant is reestablished, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be raised up and rebuilt upon Yahweh's return at Yom Kippur. I mean, and on Sukkah, what is Yahweh going to establish? Kingdom of Dode.
Wow.
So the tabernacle of Dode. Yeah.
I mean, not the Christian tabernacle, huh?
Beautiful, isn't it?
Yes, sir.